It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And you should have a pencil and paper ready because you never know when you might want to write something down. We have news from Willits, California. The tree sitter up there has declared a hunger strike in this story by Linda Williams of the Willits News. Amanda Warbliss Sensiman lowered all her food to the ground this morning from her tree sit platform about 50 feet off the ground along Highway 101 south of Willits and announced she was on a hunger strike. Warbliss has been sitting in a tree protesting the current Willits bypass project since January 28th. Her tree is currently guarded day and night by a large group of California Highway Patrol officers. The officers began preventing Sensiman supporters from delivering food and water to her starting on March 22nd. Since the first round of eight protester arrests on March 21st, there have been at least five more arrests for trespassing as of Thursday morning. CHP officers are quick to respond to any sign of photographers or reporters even approaching the work area, whether it is marked or not, chasing down the trespassers and telling them to move along or be arrested. This continues to occur even on county and state right-of-ways. Caltrans has coned off the shoulders of Highway 101 near the south end of the bypass and placed signs indicating roadwork. In reality, the only roadwork is to prevent photographers, reporters, and protesters from stopping in the hypothetical construction zone. The Caltrans official position is the clearly marked construction zone is off-limits for worker and protester safety, according to Caltrans spokesman Phil Frisbee. Why has CHP has expanded this to include a much wider area is unclear. The officers guarding the road near Sensiman's tree spend most of their time milling around next to their cars looking at the protesters gathered on the hill opposite. Caltrans vehicles and large gravel trucks are coming and going along this road throughout the day. Some Valley residents near the construction zone are questioning the need to have noisy diesel or gasoline-powered lights operating day and night in the area of the three tree sits. Sensiman told the Willits News last week she was prepared to be cut off from her supporters, having stockpiled food and water for that possibility. Last Friday, after a Caltrans supervisor read her a statement through a bullhorn, Sensiman believed officers were preparing to extract her from the tree. This week, the brush and tree cutting began along the bypass route in earnest as the contractor attempted to get the stalled project back on schedule. The sound of earth-moving equipment, chainsaws, and flail mowers has filled the valley in the area east of Sensiman's tree sit. A diesel-powered light has kept the tree sit area brightly lit at night. Sensiman had originally lowered a statement Thursday morning from her tree sit to be read at the gathering press and her supporters. The CHP sees that statement as evidence, so Sensiman read the following statement via cell phone through her adopted mother, Sarah Grusky. Currently, I am witnessing the destruction of my home. Caltrans is clearing multiple areas for destruction, cutting trees, clearing brush, despite the fact that the Migratory Bird Act is in effect as of February 1, 2013. California Highway Patrol officers have been deployed from around the state to occupy our valley. The occupation is complete with helicopter flybys and 24-hour surveillance. This project is obsolete and it will cause irreparable damage to our watershed, forest, and community. The life that this valley harbors will not survive this assault on its biological integrity. I am 24 years old and I want a future and a future for my children. I will remain on hunger strike until the following demands are met. All construction on Caltrans's current Willits bypass cease immediately pending legal resolution. And by that, she means that the Center for Biological Diversity and others have sued the California Department of Transportation about the environmental problems with the Willits bypass. The public and press are able to enter the destroyed and disturbed areas to document said destruction and violations of law, nature, and common sense. Least harmful alternatives and appropriately scaled transportation solutions for Willits and the Little Lake Valley are adopted. The Warbler says she has water, tea, and will take a little broth for the next few days. A group of about 45 of Sensiman supporters gathered at 10 a.m. this morning at the area on the west side of Highway 101 above the tree sit location for the impromptu announcement. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Spring buffalo migration is underway in the Hebgen Basin as large numbers of wild buffalo are on the move. Family groups led by pregnant cows are heading towards their calving grounds on and around Horse Butte Peninsula. Wild buffalo calving season will begin in just a few weeks. The buffalo's migration is compounded by their need to cross and travel along heavily used highways that cut through their migration corridor, especially Highway 191. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols have been extremely busy day and night, warning motorists of buffalo on or near the road. While our efforts have saved many human and buffalo lives, some people choose not to heed the warnings. This week, four wild buffalo, two females and two yearlings, were struck and killed by vehicles in separate accidents, even with all the warning signs in place. Not even glowing wands and slow paddles held by Buffalo Field Campaign patrols stopped one of the vehicles from striking and killing buffalo. Both accidents happened in the dark of night, and both the drivers were sighted. In the Gardner Basin, things are beginning to slow down a little. One buffalo was shot and killed by treaty hunters since last week. This year, over 250 wild buffalo have been killed by hunters, which is the largest hunter harvest since the 1980s. Yellowstone National Park officials have been literally encouraging hunters to kill migrating buffalo, many just outside Yellowstone's boundary, threatening that if hunters don't kill them, the government will see to their capture and to their slaughter. Earlier this winter, Yellowstone announced its intentions to kill more than 400 female buffalo. It's looking like they may be thwarted in their plans, as most of the buffalo in the Gardner Basin have been making their way south, deeper into the park, toward their calving grounds on the Blacktail Plateau. The threat of capture still looms, however. It is always possible that here in the Hebgen Basin, west of Yellowstone, the Montana Department of Livestock may initiate capture operations. We are being vigilant and prepared to respond to whatever comes. As the warming earth hints at spring, black and grizzly bears are beginning to emerge from their dens. Our field patrol's sense of bear awareness is heightened. A few grizzly bears have been spotted in Yellowstone, and on Tuesday, patrols came across the tracks of a black bear. Align your life with your ideals. Come to work for the Buffalo Field Campaign. We have immediate openings for field volunteers. Between now and June, we need people to staff our front lines patrols. In the summer, we'll need education and outreach volunteers to represent the Buffalo Field Campaign and the buffalo to Yellowstone visitors. If you are interested, passionate, and hardworking, please visit the website for information on volunteering with the Buffalo Field Campaign. The Buffalo Field Campaign's wish list featured item is the same as last week. They still need their snowplow vehicle. While they still need bikes and bike tools, they had a bit of emergency a week or so ago. Their snowplow truck just quit. Warming temperatures brought heavy, wet snow, which is extremely difficult for our plow truck to move, and after years of excellent service, she just gave out. Our wishes for a snow removal vehicle, a Bobcat tractor, or a good running four-wheel drive pickup truck, please contact Mike Meese at area code 406-646-0070 with any questions about the snowplow vehicle or the Buffalo Field Campaign. If you want to just talk to him about that, I'm sure he'd be glad to. For more information about the Buffalo Field Campaign, go to their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. If you'd like to send them a donation, the address is Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, and the zip code is 59758. Once again, the telephone number out there is 406-646-0070. And please remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And water escapes from the Suncor Oil Sands Pond on the Athabasca River in Canada. In this story reported by Scott Haggett, with editing by Gerald McCormick and Peter Galloway of the World Environment News Thomson Reuters. Contaminated water may have spilled into the Athabasca River from a broken pipe at Suncor Energy Incorporated's oil sands project in northern Alberta, sparking new fears about pollution of the river from the massive oil sands developments along its banks. The Athabasca River is the main source of drinking water for Aboriginal and other communities downstream and has been the subject of several controversial reports on its water quality. Province of Alberta's Environment Department says it does not yet know whether the water that spilled from a holding pond contained toxic materials. Samples from the pond are being sent for analysis, and it will take at least a day before results are returned. Environment Department staff have been at the project site north of Fort McMurray, Alberta, since early on Monday. Wayne Wood, a spokesman for Provincial Environment Minister Diane McQueen, said the volume of water sent into the river has not yet been determined. We are on the ground monitoring the situation, Wood said. The pipe got turned off relatively fast. Suncor, Canada's number one oil producer, and other oil sands companies store contaminated water, a byproduct of stripping tar-like bitumen from the sands, in holding ponds. These ponds became the focus of environmental protests in 2008 when nearly 1,600 ducks died after landing on a tailings pond operated by Syncrude Canada Limited. While new regulations introduced after the mass duck deaths aim to eliminate the toxic ponds, they remain controversial because of the risk of spills from them into the Athabasca River. No one in Alberta should have to be worried about the safety of their drinking water supply, but that's exactly the situation we have, said Mike Hudima, a climate and energy campaigner for Greenpeace Canada, in a statement. Suncor said industrial wastewater from its oil sands extraction and upgrading operations escaped on Monday morning after a 4-inch pipe broke from freezing, spilling water into a partially frozen outflow pond containing treated water. However, Snehe Sital, a spokeswoman for the company, said Suncor is not yet certain that any of the water actually flowed into the Athabasca River. We do not know if this process-affected water was released into the river, Sital said. We are analyzing samples of the pond and the river as part of the investigation. Sital said Suncor's oil sands project was operating normally, despite the spill. And a tiny possum may be Australia's first climate change victim. In this story, written by Thai Ung, editing by Elaine Lies and Paul Tate of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. A 1 degree rise in temperature could spell doom for a rare Australian possum within a decade, potentially making the tiny, long-tailed marsupial the continent's first victim of climate change, researchers have said. The mountain pygmy possums have been a part of Australian ecosystems for more than 25 million years, but only 2,000 to 2,600 are believed to remain in the wilds of the Snowy Mountains, a range that extends between New South Wales and Victoria states in Australia. There's so many ways that a change in temperature can spell doom for these possums in those environments, said Michael Archer, a paleontologist and naturalist at the University of New South Wales. The possums, which grow up to 14 centimeters long, about 5.5 inches, and weigh 10 to 50 grams, around an ounce, hibernate in rock piles for the 6 months of the year when snow blankets the mountains. The snow serves as an insulator that prevents rock piles from growing too cold and keeps the animals from freezing. Projections by Archer and other researchers say a 1 degree Celsius temperature rise by 2020 and a 3 degree rise by 2050, according to a study published by the journal Australian Zoologist. The mean temperature in Australia has increased by about 7-tenths of a degree C since 1960, with a 2001 to 2010 being the warmest decade on record, according to the Australian Bureau of Meteorology. A lack of snow also causes the possums to come out of hibernation before the moths and mountain plums they feed on become available, causing the animals to starve. With even a 1 degree rise in annual average temperature, they were likely to lose the snow, Archer said. The insulation is the difference between life and death in that habitat. Scientists hope to establish a breeding colony in the lowland rainforest to reacclimate the possums to warmer climates like those where their ancestors used to live. If we don't do this, it's pretty much guaranteed we're going to lose this possum to climate change, Archer said. And turning to biological diversity news, there's been a polar bear victory. The court has upheld protection and confirms a global warming threat. Polar bears will keep their hard-won federal protections. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has dismissed efforts by the state of Alaska, polar bear trophy hunters, and others to strip polar bears of their Endangered Species Act protection. The court upheld the government's 2008 decision, responding to a Center for Biological Diversity's petition and litigation to protect the Arctic bears as threatened throughout their range. The appeals court ruled that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's decision to protect the bear due to the melting of Arctic sea ice was well supported in every regard. The court also noted the listing decision was, if anything, underprotective of polar bears rather than overprotecting as the state of Alaska had claimed. Global warming is robbing polar bears of the sea ice they need to survive. Left unchecked, two-thirds of the world's polar bears, including all in Alaska, could be gone by the year 2050. If we're going to save polar bears, the Obama administration needs to move swiftly to cut greenhouse pollution, said Cassie Siegel, director of the Center's Climate Law Institute. The international community also lost an opportunity to ban the trade in polar bear parts, especially rugs, when Canada successfully opposed a U.S.-backed ban under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, to keep the animals from being commercially hunted. And the Keystone XL pipeline is moving closer to approval. The Obama administration has released an environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL project, moving this dirty, disastrous oil pipeline one step closer to approval. Keystone XL would cross the heart of the Midwest and deliver oil from Canada's tar sands all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, where much of it would be exported to other countries. Along the way, the pipeline would cut through rivers, streams, and prime wildlife habitat, including habitat for at least 20 rare and vanishing species, including whooping cranes and the pallid sturgeon. The planned pipeline would ship every day up to 35 million gallons of the dirtiest oil on the planet to refineries on the Gulf Coast. Keystone XL will move us closer to climate catastrophe, threaten our land and water with spills, and encourage further strip mining, bringing destruction of a boreal forest the size of Florida. And I want to add that the current issue of Scientific American contains an article on the carbon impact of various kinds of oil, and tar sands oil is way down. It has a really low rate of return based on the amount of energy it takes to get it. Check out that article in Scientific American. And 20,000 acres of California forest have been protected. After much work by environmental groups and the Green Northern California residents, supported by the Center for Biological Diversity, forests have won out over a vineyard industry in one of the largest conservation purchases along the North Coast in years. A $24.5 million deal was reached to set aside a 20,000-acre chunk of timberland forest in northwestern Sonoma County, dubbed the Preservation Ranch, thus derailing a state proposal to transform part of it into vineyards that would have decimated habitat for imperiled species, hurt steelhead trout and coho salmon, and eliminated the forest's capacity to sequester climate-changing carbon. The center has recently been involved in the forest-to-vineyard conversion battle in Northern California, defending beautiful biodiverse woods from being plowed over while their precious waterways are drained to grow wine grapes. We're now in court over a different damaging proposal of a vineyard forest grab known as the Fairfax Project, also in the Sonoma area. And we'll keep you up to date on how that goes. The bat-killing white-nose syndrome has reached Illinois. White-nose syndrome, a devastating disease that has killed nearly 7 million bats in the United States, has spread to Illinois. State wildlife officials confirmed that little brown bats and northern long-eared bats in four Illinois counties tested positive for the disease. There's no known cure for white-nose syndrome, and it's believed the fungus that causes it can be spread to new caves by human visitors. In 2010, the Center for Biological Diversity petitioned to protect the little brown, eastern small-footed, and northern long-eared bats under the Endangered Species Act. The center has also called for the closure of publicly owned caves to human visitation in all but scientific or emergency circumstances to prevent the spread of the fungus. If we're serious about stemming the spread of this disease and preserving bat populations throughout North America, we have to do what's needed. Right now, that means an all-out effort by the government to ensure white-nose syndrome is not made worse by people spreading it to new parts of the country, said the center's bat advocate, Molly Mattison. And unfortunately, in another story, the deadly march of white-nose syndrome carries on. This week, wildlife officials announced the disease, which has already killed 7 million bats in northern America, has now reached Georgia and South Carolina. In the 7 years since it showed up in upstate New York, it's swept into 22 states and 5 Canadian provinces. Scientists fear the continued spread of the disease, which strikes bats during hibernation, could wipe out many of North America's 24 hibernating bat species. It's chillingly clear that the next frontier for this devastating disease is the western United States and its many, many bat species that live there, says Molly Madison, a bat advocate at the center. But even now, the government officials keep allowing cave visitors to come and go in most western caves on federal land as though nothing has changed in the past 7 years. That needs to stop, or bat populations across the West may crash. And a California bill would protect bobcats from commercial fur trapping. Following a sharp rise in bobcat trapping in California, State Assemblymember Richard Bloom of Santa Monica has introduced legislation to prohibit commercial trapping of bobcats in the state. Prices for pelts have risen as the number of bobcats being killed to meet overseas demand during the 2012-2013 trapping season. Bobcat trapping created public controversy after traps were found by property owners on private lands along the boundaries of Joshua Tree National Park. Numerous locally familiar, well-loved bobcats abruptly disappeared during trapping season. The proposed law would ban the commercial trapping of bobcats in California, along with the commercial sale and export of their pelts. Under California's antiquated trapping laws, it's perfectly legal for trappers to line the boundary of a national park with traps, kill the park's wildlife, and ship the animal pelts to international markets, said Brendan Cummins, director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Wildlands Program. Bobcats are being killed for private profit of a few individuals engaged in the international fur trade, but these beautiful animals are far more valuable to the state as a living component of our wild heritage. And here's news of the wild and weird. Fossilized lightning tells an ancient story. Even something as evanescent as lightning can tell a tale. Fulgurites are geological formations created when lightning pierces the earth, melting sand to form a glassy, hollow, tubular cast of the bolt. Scientists can date these petrified electrical discharges and gather data from them on ancient climates and ecologies. A fulgurite specimen discovered in the Sahara Desert in 2007, for instance, also held bubbles of trapped carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and nitric acid created when the lightning oxidized organic material in the soil some 15,000 years ago. Researchers were able to conclude from the gases that the ecology of the Sahara back then, unlike the dry desert of today, consisted of hearty grasses and shrubs typical of semi-arid environments. Fresh evidence that the Sahara was once a more hospitable place and that lightning really is illuminating. And a suit has been filed over uranium mine threatening the Grand Canyon. The Center for Biological Diversity, the Havasupai Tribe, and two other organizations have sued the U.S. Forest Service for greenlighting operations at the Canyon uranium mine near Grand Canyon National Park without completing or even starting formal tribal consultations and without updating the Federal Environmental Review, written in 1986. These steps are crucial because the mine lies within an area of critical religious and cultural importance to the Havasupai and other tribes. It could harm wildlife, including endangered species like the California condor, and would risk polluting and depleting precious groundwater for wells and springs in and around the Grand Canyon. The mine also falls within the 1-million-acre mineral withdrawal, also known as mining halt, approved by the Obama administration in January 2012 to protect Grand Canyon's watershed from new uranium mining impacts. The ban, spurred by litigation and pressure from the center and its allies, prohibits new mining claims and development on old claims lacking valid existing rights. The Forest Service last year granted those rights for the Canyon mine, but as the center's Taylor McKinnon said, sacrificing water culture and wildlife for the uranium industry was a bad idea in 1986. Doing so now while ignoring 27 years of new information is absurd. And here's some more news of the wild and weird. Snallagosters, gumboroos, and other extinct imaginary beasts. In 1910, William Thomas Cox, Minnesota's first state forester, completed a fantasy field guide to the wild imaginary beasts of the United States. Entitled Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods, it is full of tall tales that Cox recorded from logging camps. Meet the Snollagoster, an immense crocodilian swamp monster of the southeast that, limbless, move through the mire, hunting woodcutters by way of a propeller-tipped tail. Get to know the Tote Raw Shagama, a northeastern biped that could swap hooves for paws, confusing loggers by leaving tracks that changed from moose to bear and back again. Cox's lumberjack yarns were retold from camp to camp and evolved as loggers left the felled forests of the east for virgin groves out west, where he collected stories of even more critters, for example, the hairless gumbaroo of the Pacific coast, a bear-like creature with rubber buttocks that would bounce bullets back at hunters. And three U.S. turtles have won international protection. Every year, more than 2 million live wild turtles are snatched from the United States and exported to Asia, destined for slaughter for the food and medicine markets. Thanks in part to a 2011 Center for Biological Diversity petition, the international community has taken notice and acted. Last week, parties to the Convention on Trade and International Trade in endangered species of wild fauna and flora voted to regulate and monitor international trade in Blanding's turtles, spotted turtles, and diamondback terrapins. In 2012, the center petitioned to protect the Blanding's and spotted turtles, along with 51 other imperiled reptiles and amphibians under the Endangered Species Act. Turtle traders are depleting U.S. populations at a frightening rate. It's got to stop soon or we're going to lose these incredible animals from the wild, said the center's Colette Adkins-Geese. Commercial trade only compounds the problems native turtles already face, from habitat destruction, water pollution, and being hit and killed by cars. And millions of marine mammals have been saved from harmful sonar. After opposition from the Center for Biological Diversity and others, the California Coastal Commission has rejected a dangerous plan by the U.S. Navy to engage in sonar and explosives trainings that would cause permanent hearing loss to an estimated 1,600 whales and other marine mammals, including endangered blue whales, and result in more than 100 fatalities off the coast of Southern California. The Navy's plan would also cause millions of cases of temporary hearing loss and significant disruption of vital behaviors. Navy sonar has been implicated in the hearing loss and subsequent mass strandings of marine mammals like whales. Even one low-frequency active sonar loudspeaker can be as loud as a twin-engine fighter jet at takeoff, yet the Navy frequently uses high-intensity and mid-frequency sonar. Underwater explosives not only threaten marine mammals' hearing, but also cause grave physical damage such as hemorrhages and other kinds of tissue trauma. We celebrated this latest victory with the California Coastal Commission, but we're also watchdogging the Navy's other planned deadly war games. Earlier this year, the National Marine Fisheries Service proposed to allow the Navy to harm marine mammals up to 9.5 million times off the coasts of Hawaii and Southern California, and 21.8 million times in the Atlantic over 5 years. And world fails to ban international trade in polar bear parts. A U.S. proposal to ban the international commercial trade in polar bear parts was defeated by parties to the CITES. Countries voted to allow the destructive polar bear rug trade, primarily through Canada, to continue, despite strong support from Russia of the U.S.-backed ban. About 800 polar bears are killed by hunters every year, primarily in the Canadian Arctic. Half of these bears' skins end up in international trade. Because polar bears are coming under severe pressure from sea ice melt caused by climate change and are unlikely to survive under multiple threats, in 2012 the Center formally requested that the United States sanction Canada for violating a 1973 agreement on the conservation of polar bears, a treaty that prohibits polar bear hunting unless conducted under sound conservation practices. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update for this week. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz for another Earth First Update. We also rebroadcast the Earth First Update on Friday afternoons at 3 o'clock. In Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to the Earth First Update on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, on Mondays at 9:30. And if you'd like to download a podcast of this transmission, you can go to radioforall.net and search for Earth First Update. We want to thank you for listening. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Do tune in again.